Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Records in 4 out of 7 key climate indicators were broken last year, UN scientists said on Wednesday. The alert from the World Meteorological Organization, or WMO, came as the UN Secretary-General renewed his call for governments everywhere to end their reliance on fossil fuels before we incinerate our only home, he said. According to WMO's flagship State of the Global Climate Report, records were set last year in greenhouse gas concentrations, sea level rise, ocean heat and ocean acidification. And the fact that last year was not the warmest on record is likely only because there was a La Niña event at the start and end of the year. This provided a temporary cooling effect and left average global temperatures about 1.1 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial level. Regardless of this temporary reprieve, scientists are in no doubt that the long-term trend is for rising temperatures. Their impact can already be seen on coral bleaching and other less visible areas, said WMO's Omar Badour.
The problem is that not only the climate system is changing, but also the ecosystems associated with the Earth system are also completely changing. For instance, the biological life in the ocean species are being extinct because of this warming of the ocean and acidification.
The UN Health Agency, WHO, has said that Mozambique's first confirmed case of wild poliovirus in 30 years is greatly concerning after the outbreak was confirmed on Wednesday. Mozambican authorities confirmed that a child had contracted the disease in northeastern Tete province. This marks the second imported case of wild poliovirus in southern Africa this year, following an outbreak in Malawi in February. WHO's Dr. Machidiso Moeti, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa, said that the UN agency was supporting southern African governments to step up the polio fight, including by carrying out large-scale effective campaigns to halt the virus. The single polio case in Mozambique is the country's first to be detected since 1992. Genomic sequencing analysis indicated that the new case is linked to a strain that had been circulating in Pakistan in 2019 and which was similar to the case reported in Malawi earlier this year. More than 7 in 10 children, a staggering 1.5 billion youngsters, still go without family benefits or other welfare support, UN agencies have warned, in a call to governments to do more to tackle poverty and child labour. Highlighting evidence from a number of studies conducted since 2010, the International Labour Organization, ILO, and UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, underlined that social protection has multiple benefits, from helping families to withstand economic or health shocks, to reducing the need to send children to work. Policies exist to promote social protection, both UN agencies noted, adding that unless governments act decisively, the COVID-19 pandemic, ongoing conflicts, rising poverty and climate change will only increase the likelihood of child labour. Latest UN data indicates that more than 160 million children worldwide are still engaged in child labour and progress has stalled since 2016. Without mitigation strategies, the number of children in child labour could rise by 8.9 million by the end of 2022, ILO and UNICEF said. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Marjorie Cohen joins us to discuss in detail the leaked draft Supreme Court opinion that might overrule Roe v. Wade.
And I will also discuss the other rights that we take for granted, which are now in jeopardy if the Supreme Court eliminates the constitutional right to abortion.
We speak with attorney Zach Corrigan of Food and Water Watch. We're going to speak with him about the Trump administration getting rid of regulations governing hog slaughterhouses and how dangerous this is for people who consume pork.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
Kathy Boudin, a significant figure in the fight against mass incarceration, died on May 1st in New York City. She would have been 79 years old on May 19th, a birth date she proudly shared with Malcolm X and Ho Chi Minh. Kathy was the co-founder with Cheryl Wilkins of the Center for Justice at Columbia University in New York City. She had served 22 years in Bedford Hills Prison, a maximum security prison for women in New York, after pleading guilty to robbery and felony murder in connection with the 1983 Brinks armed truck heist, where she was a passenger in the getaway van. She was a white supporter of the Small Black Liberation Army, which was formed in New York City after the government's destruction of the Black Panther Party. In order to raise funds for the Black Liberation Army, Kathy had agreed to support the action by being in the getaway van to act as a decoy. The robbery went awry. Two police officers and a security guard were killed. Kathy was quickly arrested. She was unarmed and did not kill anyone, but the felony murder law in New York defines a person as guilty if they are a participant in a crime where someone dies. Kathy Boudin was an extraordinarily kind and empathetic person, widely admired with many friends, including me, Michael Smith, the co-host of Law & Disorder Radio. She was proof of the fact that people cannot and should not be defined by the worst thing they've ever done in their lives, and that they are capable of change, transformation, and redemption. An extraordinary organizer, Kathy was able to modify the composition of the New York State Parole Board. Instead of understanding the potential for human transformation, the parole board hearings had only focused on the original crime committed by the applicant and disregarded the good work they had performed in prison and the remorse they had expressed for their crimes. The United States holds more people in prison, 2.3 million, than any other country in the world. Millions of black people are in the criminal justice system, including on probation and parole. Hundreds of thousands have been denied the right to vote and to receive public assistance of any kind. Michelle Alexander calls the situation the new Jim Crow. Kathy understood that the phenomena of mass incarceration was a reaction to the civil rights movement of the 1960s. She was a founder of RAPP, R-A-P-P, Release Aging People from Prison, and a leader in prison justice reform, which has led to a significant drop in the number of incarcerated people in New York State. Kathy was the first woman in New York State to earn a master's degree while in prison, where she developed programs to educate people about AIDS, parenting from afar, and the securing of a college education after the Pell Grant program was discontinued. Kathy was the daughter of the great civil liberties attorney Leonard Boudin, who represented Paul Robeson and Daniel Ellsberg. She was the mother of Chase Boudin, the progressive district attorney in San Francisco, and the sister of retired federal court judge Michael Boudin. We will link to appreciative articles in The Guardian and in The New Yorker about Kathy. Kathy Boudin, presente.
In headline news, on May 3rd, a leaked draft Supreme Court opinion was published in Politico. Samuel Alito's draft decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization would overrule the landmark cases of Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Alito writes that abortion is no longer a constitutional right. He leaves it up to the states to enact and enforce laws restricting a woman's right to choose. Alito wrote that, quote, Roe and Casey must be overruled, finding no constitutional right to abortion. If four more conservative members of the Supreme Court agree, which Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett reportedly do at the present time, all reproductive and privacy rights will be imperiled. Our own Marjorie Cohn is here to discuss the privacy and legal ramifications of a Supreme Court decision overruling Roe. Marjorie is Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she taught from 1991 to 2016. She's a former criminal defense attorney and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. She lectures, writes, and provides commentary for local, regional, national, and international media.
On May 6, Marjorie published an article in Truthout titled, "Will Demise of Roe Be in Death Knell for Contraception? Marriage Rights." Marjorie, what a pleasure it is to have you on to discuss this soon-to-be historic legal decision.
Thanks so much, and I wish I could say that it's a pleasure as well, but it's very disturbing, and I'm sure you agree with that.
Yes, well, I'm curious, Marjorie, with the increasingly conservative and religious composition of the Supreme Court, why was the leaked Alito draft opinion still a surprise?
You know, that's a really good question, Heidi. For 50 years, the anti-choice, anti-abortion people have pursued a systematic strategy to overturn Roe v. Wade. The Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, two right-wing organizations, have come up with lists of judges who will reliably overturn Roe v. Wade, and that is the list from which Trump drew his three Supreme Court nominees who eventually joined the court, and his lower federal court judges, 200 some of them. Nevertheless, in spite of calls for the coming out and voting to have justices, I don't want to say justices, I usually don't call them justices, but members of the Supreme Court who will uphold Roe v. Wade in talking about abortion rights and reproductive rights, the Democrats have been in denial. Obama was asked, I think early in his term, whether he would push and make a priority a law, a federal law, that would codify Roe v. Wade. And he said, no, it's not my priority. You know, he was making a priority of health care and other things. Certainly that has proved to be a major mistake. But now we have a minority in terms of representing people in this country on the Supreme Court, nominated by a president who received a minority of the popular vote, on the verge of overturning Roe v. Wade and possibly many other constitutional rights as well. And yet it's still a shock. What Alito writes in his draft opinion is that the Constitution does not confer a right to abortion. Roe and Casey must be overturned, and the authority to regulate abortion must be returned to the people and their elective representatives. And according to Politico, four right-wing justices or members of the court, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, voted in December to overturn Roe v. Wade and still maintain that same position. So we will know by the end of June whether Roe v. Wade is indeed dead or not.
Now, Marjorie, let's go back several years. Tell our listeners what the holding of Roe was based on. What legal reasoning?
Well, in 1973, the Supreme Court held in Roe v. Wade that a woman has a right to an abortion until the fetus becomes viable. That's about 23 weeks of pregnancy. And in Roe, the court said that the Constitution protects a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. The court relied on long-standing precedents, holding that the Fourth Amendment's concept of personal liberty prohibits governmental interference with personal decisions about marriage, contraception, procreation, family relationships, child rearing, and education.
Marjorie, I don't think as many people are as familiar with the subsequent case that we've referenced, Casey. Can you tell us why that case was important?
Well, 20 years after Roe v. Wade was decided, the Supreme Court in Planned Parenthood versus Casey reaffirmed the central holding of Roe, that a pregnant woman has the right to an abortion before the fetus becomes viable. And the court said that states cannot limit the right to abortion if it would cause an undue burden on a woman's right constitutional right to abortion. And Casey highlighted the settled principle that the Constitution places limits on a state's right to interfere with a person's most basic decisions about family and parenthood, as well as bodily integrity. And Casey has been reaffirmed several times since it was decided.
And are there any other rights that Casey serves to protect that would be imperiled if it were overturned?
Yes, indeed, Heidi. The court cited Casey with approval in its decision in Washington versus Glucksberg, in which it listed the right to abortion alongside the rights to marry, to use contraception, to have children, and to bodily integrity, which it said are recognized in a long line of cases that interpret the Due Process Clause. The Due Process Clause requires that the government provide due process, fairness, to people before the government can deprive them of life, liberty, or property. Now, in the case of Lawrence versus Texas, the court again relied on Casey to hold that states cannot criminalize homosexual conduct. And the Lawrence court said that the right to liberty under the Due Process Clause guarantees a realm of personal liberty that the government may not enter. The court then used those same precedents to hold in Obergefell versus Hodges that the Constitution protects same-sex marriage. And the court wrote, quote, like choices concerning contraception, family relationships, procreation, and child-rearing, decisions concerning marriage are among the most intimate that an individual can make and are therefore inherent in the concept of individual autonomy protected by the Due Process Clause. Now, there are people suffering early miscarriages or ectopic pregnancies could be adversely affected if Roe is overturned. Fertility procedures such as in vitro fertilization, egg extractions, and stem cell procedures could be outlawed. And what Alito said in his draft was that abortion is an unenumerated right. That means it doesn't appear in the Constitution. It's not written in the Constitution. Well, neither is contraception. Neither is homosexual conduct. Neither is same-sex marriage. Neither is the right to travel. Neither is the right to vote. Neither is the right to interracial marriage, which was enshrined, the right to interracial marriage was enshrined in Loving versus Virginia by the Supreme Court in the 60s. So it's not just abortion that's on the line, and that's not a just, that's a big, big thing, and it's going to have vast ramifications, but also many, many other of our constitutional rights that we've relied upon are fair game with this right-wing Christian theocratic majority that we now have on our Supreme Court.
Now, Marjorie, you are well aware that in the draft opinion that was leaked in the Dobbs case, Alito wrote that the decision concerns only the constitutionality of abortion and no other right, which you have just suggested is not true. Can you paint a quick picture of what a post-Roe society might look like with other rights impacted negatively? Will women, for example, have to leave the state? Will people who do provide abortions be imprisoned?
Well, let me just go back to the Alito draft opinion that said only the constitutionality of abortion is at stake. Alito wrote in this opinion, and by the way, the case we're talking about is the Dobbs case, which is a Mississippi case, which has to do with a Mississippi law that prohibits abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. And in this draft opinion in Dobbs, Alito wrote, quote, we emphasize that our decision concerns the constitutional right to abortion and no other right. Nothing in this opinion should be understood to cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion, unquote. Nevertheless, Alito in his draft eviscerates the fundamental underpinnings of the rights to contraception, sexual freedom, and same-sex marriage. He holds that abortion, which is not specifically mentioned in the Constitution, is not deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition and is not implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. On the contrary, Alito writes, an unbroken tradition of prohibiting abortion on pain of criminal punishment persisted from the earliest days of the common law until 1973, which is when Roe was decided. Well, he's wrong about that. He spent several pages and a 30-page annex citing all of the criminal statutes in states going way back to the, I believe, the 1800s. But abortion was allowed for many years until the quickening of the fetus, and that is generally halfway through the pregnancy, so he was wrong about that. Alito also, and this is really alarming, specifically criticizes Lawrence v. Texas, which says that there's a constitutional right to homosexual conduct, and Obergefell versus Hodges, which says that there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. So Alito specifically criticizes both Lawrence and Obergefell, writing that they are not deeply rooted in history. But as Erwin Chemerinsky wrote in the LA Times, unless the court's going to repudiate all of the other privacy rights, it's impossible to deny that laws prohibiting abortion also intrude on a woman's liberty. And in his draft opinion, Alito disavowed the entire line of jurisprudence that undergirds Roe and talks about these unenumerated rights. So even though he said, don't worry, this is only abortion, don't believe it for a minute. Now, back to your second question, what will a post-Roe society look like? About half of the states will outlaw or severely limit abortion. 13 states with so-called trigger laws would immediately ban abortion. 5 states that have pre-Roe abortion bans could once again enforce them. And 14 states would ban abortion before fetal viability. And prohibition of and restrictions on abortion would disproportionately affect poor women and people of color. That means that women who have the means, the financial means, to travel to a state where abortion is legal, such as California, I'm proud to say, can do that. Poor women cannot. But some states are going to criminalize women going to another state to have an abortion. For example, Missouri copied the Texas bounty hunter law. Texas has SB 8, which is a law that says that women can't have abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, and it actually deputizes private citizens to sue any doctor or clinic or paramedic or Uber driver who drives a woman to have an abortion and to receive $10,000 and receive attorney's fees. And so under this Mississippi law, private citizens can sue abortion patients who leave Missouri to get an abortion. We will see, and I think most abortions now are medication abortions where people take pills. But even those medication abortions are going to be outlawed. In Texas, Louisiana, Arizona, and several other states, they have banned telehealth over the internet for medication abortion or abortion pills. And we can see additional banning of medication abortions, even if they come from another state or people order them online. Janet Yellen just came out with a prediction that outlawing abortion will have a very, very negative impact on the economy because it will increase the odds of women living in poverty or getting public assistance. And also, I think, and we're going to talk, I know, in a few minutes about parallels between the Dred Scott decision and Alito's draft opinion in Dobbs, but I think what's going to happen ultimately, as state after state criminalizes abortion and many states criminalize leaving states to have abortions, an underground railroad, so to speak, which is an interesting kind of parallel to Dred Scott as well. And that is that there will be systems set up where people seeking abortions can be safely transported to other states. I'm also very proud to say that my state, California, is implementing something called Sanctuary, where there is a fund to help women who can't afford it travel to California for abortions, put them up, lodging, food, transportation, etc. So I think we're going to see ultimately this Underground Railroad.
Let's talk briefly about stare decisis, what that is for our listeners, and what this particular decision does for that basic legal principle.
Well, stare decisis means that the Supreme Court respects precedent, that they don't lightly overrule prior decisions. In fact, it's like moving heaven and earth to overrule a prior decision. And if Alito and these four right-wingers on the Supreme Court who appear to be ready to vote with him do overturn Roe v. Wade, that would be an egregious violation of stare decisis. Now, Alito said in his draft that stare decisis does not, quote, compel unending adherence to Roe's abuse of a judicial authority. This is after case after case after case of the Supreme Court over the last 50 years has reaffirmed Roe v. Wade. For this Supreme Court, stare decisis is honored only when they like the prior decision, apparently. The Supreme Court has said in a number of cases that while stare decisis is not an inexorable command, even in constitutional cases, the doctrine carries such persuasive force that we have always required a departure from precedent to be supported by some special justification. And that's a quote from many Supreme Court cases. There was a case called Dickerson back in 1999 where the Supreme Court was invited to overturn Miranda. And yet, the majority upheld Miranda. They said, we do not think there is such justification for overruling Miranda. Miranda has become embedded in routine police practice to the point where the warnings have become part of our national culture. Well, it's now evident that the special justification for overruling Roe v. Wade is simply that three new Catholics joined the court thanks to Donald Trump.
Marjorie, Alito discussed eugenics in his draft opinion. Please explain this.
Well, first of all, I want to say that Alito also refers to abortionists, you know, as if they're some kind of executioners. And this language could change by the final opinion at the end of June when these other four right-wingers apparently sign on to the opinion. But Alito also mentioned Clarence Thomas's pet theory about abortion rights being deployed to harm black women and their babies. This is the eugenics argument. Black people accounted for 38% of abortions in 2019 compared to 33% for whites. According to Centers for Disease Control, black people make up about 13% of the population while white people make up 60%, and there are many factors that cause that. Black people are less likely to have access to reproductive health care, good sex education, and health insurance, all of which lead to a higher abortion rate. Also, Alito drew heavily on treatises written by an English jurist, Sir Matthew Hale, who described abortion as a great crime and a great misprison. Hale distinguished his career by securing the executions of two women as witches and writing the definitive text for a marital rape exemption that said that husbands cannot be culpable of raping their wives because, quote, by their mutual matrimonial consent and contract, the wife hath given up herself. And so this is just a taste of some of the outrageous things in this draft opinion by Alito.
Marjorie, you mentioned the Dred Scott decision. What parallels are there between Dred Scott and Alito's draft opinion?
Well, this was very well documented in Jesse Jackson's recent Chicago Sun-Times piece, but I think it's striking. The Dred Scott decision was an 1857 decision where a very politicized court ruled that African Americans were not citizens under the Constitution and thus had no rights that a white man needed to respect or that the federal government could protect. And the Dred Scott decision contributed to the political divisions that ended in the Civil War. Chief Justice Roger Taney wrote the Dred Scott opinion. Now, as with Alito's draft, the Dred Scott opinion was leaked ahead of time. And also, like Alito's draft, it was preceded by a disingenuous campaign of lies to urge people to respect the decisions of the Supreme Court because they're grounded in law, not politics. In Dred Scott, Taney relied on a very rigid standard of interpretation that ignored stare decisis. He argued that black people could not be American citizens because at the time of the founding, they were considered beings of an inferior order, and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, and that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit, unquote. In Alito's draft, he also adopts a rigid standard. He argues the Constitution doesn't contain any words about abortion, that abortion was widely outlawed at the time of the founding of the country. And of course, at the founding, women were not citizens. They didn't have the right to vote. They were regarded as property of their husbands. And the Dred Scott decision left the question of slavery to the states. Alito's draft leaves the question of abortion to the states. And in Dred Scott, Taney reviewed the laws of the original U.S. states, distorting and ignoring history. Alito did the same thing. Taney said that the decision would help temper the growing controversy over slavery that was dividing the country. Alito said that there have been such divisions since Roe that overturning Roe will help reduce political divisions. And of course, we know that's not correct. There are thousands and thousands of people in the streets, and it's really turned the country upside down. And Alito's opinion, overturning precedent of 50 years, at least three judges in the majority said at their confirmation hearing swore that it was settled law when they testified, is really beyond the pale.
Marjorie, as I listen to you, I can't help but think that the damage also goes far beyond liberty for women, that, you know, stare decisis. It also speaks to the integrity and the perceived integrity by Americans of the U.S. Supreme Court. We know that, for example, Congress has a very poor rating in the polls. And I think that with decisions like this, it's got to speak so poorly on institutions of democracy, such as the High Court.
You're absolutely right, and Chief Justice John Roberts is scrambling to protect the legitimacy of his court. He's trying to take a neutral position and not vote to overturn Roe, but still uphold the Mississippi law. But the leak has really thrown them into a tizzy and polarized the country in kind of an unprecedented way. Of course, the Civil War was pretty polarizing. But I think we're going to see repercussions in the midterm elections. Hopefully, it will bring Democrats out to vote for pro-choice governors who can stop some of these anti-abortion state laws. But it's more important than ever that people march, that they write and contact their elected representatives. They write letters to the editor. They write op-eds and do anything we can to stop what looks like a raging freight train to eliminate the right to abortion and many of our other rights.
Marjorie, let's touch base again in early July when the decision is formally released, because it'll be interesting to see if they made any changes since the draft.
Sounds good, Heidi.
And Marjorie, thank you so much for your high-quality work on this topic, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Heidi. You too.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. I'm going to go to the hospital.
U.S. Freedom of Information Act is a 1967 law requiring federal agencies to disclose information to the public. The rationale for this law is that a government of, by, and for the people is transparent and accountable to those people. Getting the act passed was a democratic victory of the movement in the 1960s. Over the last half century, FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act, FOIA requests became critical tools for both journalists and activists seeking to illuminate federal agency activities. The problem is, it's getting harder to wrest information from recalcitrant government agencies. Federal agencies began heavily redacting, that is, blacking out information or ignoring requests entirely. And delays got noticeably longer. The law gives agencies 20 business days to respond. But in 2019, the average wait time for a reply to your FOIA request was nearly 6 months, 177 days. This forces public safety groups to begin expensive and lengthy lawsuits to obtain data that's rightfully ours. Today's guest has experienced this frustrating process, first requesting information, then waiting years for respective agencies to respond. After being granted expeditious processing for a request that would shed critical light on proposed Trump rules, the agency sat on his request for years. He was finally forced to sue. Our guest is attorney Zach Corrigan. He's the champion of food safety. Mr. Corrigan is a senior attorney at Food and Water Watch. In 2018, Mr. Corrigan became concerned when Donald Trump removed 40% of the federal meat inspectors from the slaughterhouse lines and allowed for faster slaughterhouse lines in our nation's hog slaughterhouses. Letting hog slaughterhouses regulate themselves makes foodborne illnesses nearly inevitable because of Trump's rules turned over inspections to the untrained plant employees and rolled back adequate safety testing. COVID should have taught us that human health is inexorably linked to the health of all other animals and the environment. Yet even the Biden administration is now pandering to the meat industry by deregulating it. Attorney Zach Corrigan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you so much.
And listeners, I want to also welcome as a guest co-host, attorney Tamara Bedick. She's the president of the National Lawyers Guild chapter in New York City and the head of their Animal Rights Committee. So, Tamara, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for your help on this. Zach Corrigan, you're the senior attorney for Food and Water Watch and the lead counsel in the case of the United States Department of Agriculture, that's the USDA. Can you tell us a bit about Food and Water Watch? What is your mission?
Certainly, Michael. Food and Water Watch is a national nonprofit organization that is organized to fight for safe food, clean water, and a livable climate. Our focus is really fighting those corporations and other destructive economic interests that put their profits ahead of everything that we all care about. And so that's who Food and Water Watch is.
Zach, what is the USDA's new swine inspection system, or NSIS?
Yeah, so this was a 2019 rule by the Trump administration's USDA that really sought to undo 100 years of food safety regulations. Your listeners probably know about Upton Sinclair and the book The Jungle, which detailed the horrific conditions in the stockyards out in Chicago and the public outcry that that novel engendered. And Congress and Teddy Roosevelt acted and passed monumental piece of legislation called the Federal Meat Inspection Act. And it required that each and every animal get evaluated by a federally trained inspector prior to the animal slaughter, and every single carcass was inspected by such an inspector after. Now, that system had been working. It could be stronger, certainly, but the industry has had its sights on this law for some time now because it really inhibits their ability to produce meat as quickly as they want. Like, they would prefer to produce meat like widgets. And so at the behest of industry in 2019, the USDA sought to undo the Federal Meat Inspection Act by promulgating the new swine inspection system, which had two real fundamental changes. First, it removed inspectors, federal inspectors, from the lines doing tasks like evaluating animals in motion to make sure that they don't have serious physical and mental problems, and then preventing them from stealing lymph nodes and other conditions of animals and carcasses after slaughter. And instead, these responsibilities were given to the plant employees themselves to have primary responsibility to perform what are essentially federal government inspections. Literally, the companies are policing themselves. And because of this, because it's a transfer of authority to the plant employees, this allowed the agency to lift limits on line speeds so that the plants can rev up their lines and produce more hog carcasses, which become the pork that is on all of our plates.
I wanted to ask you about line speed, Zach. Your FOIA request was intended to compare violation rates for carcasses with fecal matter in the pilot program plants versus the violation rate in the traditional slower slaughterhouses. Is that right? And what did you find?
That's right, Michael. This is a great example of how we were able to use the Freedom of Information Act to assist our advocacy work and to assist our eventual litigation challenging this new swine inspection system rulemaking. We filed a Freedom of Information Act back when the agency first proposed this rule in 2018 because the agency had put forward a really conclusory, scant document detailing its justification for these new rule changes, primarily relying on a model system that involved five plants and a limited set of data for these plants that had been operating for the past 15 years. So we filed a FOIA request, and for your listeners who are aware of the vagaries of FOIA requests, we're actually granted expedited processing on the request, which is a rarity. I think I've had in my 20-year career a handful granted. But they granted it because we had persuaded them that this data, which was about 27 items, different subject matters of different types of data underlying this new system, we convinced them that this was really necessary for us to be able to comment and assess the rule proposal. Well, the comment period on the rules came and went, and we only had received a few of our types of documents, despite the expeditious processing. And then 6 months later, we still had not received most of our documents. And after the rule was finalized, we finally went ahead and sued to obtain the documents. And one of the things we were most interested in was the performance of these pilot plants that had been operating under the system. The USDA had claimed that these plants had much lower violation rates for fecal matter and digestive contents on carcasses. I mean, this is gross stuff, right? But these are real live living things that when you slaughter them and you eviscerate them, their internal components, like fecal matter and digestive contents, get on carcasses. And one of the primary things that inspectors do is make sure that the carcasses that end up becoming our pork supply aren't contaminated with fecal matter. And so we were very surprised that the agency the limited data that it had showed that with inspectors largely out of the process and with plant employees looking at carcasses, that there was going to be such a lower violation rate for fecal matter and digestive contents on carcasses. And so part of our FOIA request was that we actually looked at this. Eventually, that data we ultimately were able to obtain because of our FOIA litigation.
So were you ultimately able to compare the violation rate of pigs in the traditional slower slaughterhouses versus the pigs killed under the USDA's new swine inspection system? And what did you find when you compared them?
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, this was such a large FOIA request and so many documents, and the agency, as soon as we sued, folded and started producing documents. They didn't put up much of a fight. They knew they were required to provide these records. And, you know, I would get 1,000 pages every couple weeks. And one day, kind of unceremoniously, a document showed up amongst these that the agency had produced, and it was the violation rates for both the plants that had been piloting the new inspection system and large traditional plants. And what do you know? These plants that had been piloting the new system had nearly twice the violation rates for fecal matter and digestive contents than the traditional plants. And the agency, in its report prior to that it had used to justify its new swine system, had tanked the data. It had weighted the data so it made it look like their violation rates were much smaller. It was astounding. I nearly fell off my chair. And this data then became one of the main reasons that we went to challenge the underlying rulemaking for being arbitrary and capricious, because they had failed to consider that actually these plants result in higher violation rates for fecal matter on the carcasses, because what do you know? That's what happens when you have untrained plant employees charged with doing the inspections under this new system.
Let me remind our listeners that we're speaking with attorney Zach Corrigan, who's the lead senior attorney at Food and Water Watch. He's a champion of food safety. Zach, let's make sure we understand what we're talking about here. What kind of contamination do we find? Is this at the micro level, or can you actually see it?
Yeah, that's what's the amazing thing about this. A lot of what makes people sick isn't visible. Pathogens are in our meat supply, like salmonella, and it's very important that consumers cook their meat adequately. And we would like the USDA to do more to regulate these invisible pathogens, but like salmonella. But actually, we're not even talking about this perhaps trickier form of contamination where it requires testing. We're talking about visible feces on the carcass. And the agency has an absolute zero tolerance for carcasses with this contamination, because this is how this contamination carries the invisible contaminants, and this is exactly how people get sick. And frankly, even if it didn't have the pathogens, people, when they're buying their meat, expect that when it has a USDA inspected label on it, they have gone through and made sure that they aren't paying for product that is contaminated with feces. Our data showed that after the carcasses had gone through this privatized inspection process, plants under this new system had close to twice the violation rate that were not in this system. And that meant for the 15% of meat that is currently slaughtered under this kind of pilot system, there was significant levels of fecal matter that was ending up in the product that we all purchase.
Zach, how many Americans get sick or hospitalized every year due to contaminated pork?
Yeah, according to, it's quite a few. I think this will surprise some of your listeners. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, contaminated pork alone may cause as many as 1.5 million cases of foodborne illnesses, 7,000 hospitalizations, and 200 deaths each year. So, and this is likely an underreporting. Remember that most of the time when you're sick, you don't know what caused you to get foodborne illness. Oftentimes it's people say, oh, I got a stomach bug. Well, that's likely foodborne illness. And if it's not serious enough for you to go to the doctor, you may lose a sick day, you may take a sick day, you might not be as productive. It may definitely incur costs, but you're not likely to report it.
Is it your contention that this number would rise under the new Trump system?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to gauge what this would look like, but our experts that we have in helping us assess the system and challenge the new system in court firmly believe that when you diminish government inspections and hand it over to plant employees with no required training, the result is likely to be increased illness. And that's what we're very concerned about.
Attorney Zach Corrigan, before I ask you to describe the workforce in these slaughterhouses, I wanted to go back to a point you made before about how these new rules came in. They were the result of lobbying by the industry itself. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. This is a long campaign that the pork producers have pressed to make it so that they can produce pork more cheaply, largely for import and export as well.
Yeah, this is another example of many of the terrible reversal of the situation in our country, where we now have the fox guarding the chicken coop. Zach, can you describe the workforce in these slaughterhouses? What kind of physical injuries do we see amongst these workers? And what has the Organization of Safety and Health done to ensure workers' safety?
So meat and poultry plants are among the harshest working environments in the U.S. Workers stand close together, side by side, both sides of long conveyor belts, using sharp knives and scissors to cut carcasses. They make the same forceful cuts and movements thousands of times per day. So a typical poultry worker handles dozens of birds per minute. In the holiday months, workers can put in 8 to 10 hour days, 6 or 7 days a week to meet demand. What folks may not know is the meat and poultry slaughtering and process companies report more severe injuries such as amputations and injuries or illnesses that result in overnight stays in hospitals to OSHA than industries that are, you know, popularly conceived of as dangerous, like sawmills or industrial building constructions, oil and gas drilling. The meat industry is a very dangerous industry. And so when we're increasing line speeds, like the pork manufacturers have been pushing to do, it means more injury, more dangerous conditions for workers as well.
So let's talk about COVID rates in these slaughterhouses. Is COVID something you're concerned about?
Yes. So this was something that we learned of the hard way. The same conditions that are bad for workers in terms of repetitive stress disorder and cutting injuries proved to be disastrous for workers who were exposed to COVID. So you have workers in these plants working close together for long stretches of time. It made these slaughterhouses literally vectors of disease in 2020. An October 2020 report from the House of Representatives found that the largest meat packing companies, which represent over 80% of the market for beef and 60% of the market for pork in the United States, companies you probably have heard of, JBS, Tyson Foods, Smithfield, Cargill, and the National Beef Packing Company, had at least 59,000 meatpacking world infected Zika virus during the first year of the pandemic in 2020. Sadly, 752 workers have died from the illness, and this is likely an underestimate. The CDC estimates that about 9% of workers were diagnosed with COVID, and that's likely an underestimate as well. Just to demonstrate how much these plants were vectors of this disease, one study in Nebraska found that in the eight counties with the highest COVID-19 rates were also home to the largest meat processing facilities. So I don't know if many of us realized until this COVID-19 outbreak that it wasn't just these plants are dangerous for the workers, obviously dangerous for consumers and to animals, but also were a public health hazard, dangerous to the surrounding community members as well.
We're speaking with attorney Zach Corrigan. Zach, you mentioned earlier that 40 slaughterhouses produce over 90% of U.S. pork for consumers. That's a really consolidated market, not exactly a monopoly, but what we would call an oligopoly. Is this consolidation bad for consumers?
Absolutely, and that was another lesson that we learned the hard way with COVID. The meat industry, which is very consolidated, was able to use their tremendous economic and then political power to convince the Trump administration to issue an executive order that deemed their workers essential and keep plants open, even though people were getting sick. And even though the U.S. was exporting 30% of its pork, which could have been rerouted to domestic sales. This was not about a shortage of pork. This was a cost that was being borne by the industry. It wanted to continue to export and produce products, and it put its own workers directly in the firing line of this disease, forcing them to continue to work and using their tremendous economic and political power to lobby the Trump administration to allow this to happen.
Now, Smithfield Foods is no longer U.S.-owned. Are there other slaughterhouses that are similarly owned by other countries that continue to carry the U.S. name? And if so, how might foreign ownership play into this?
Yeah, I think people would be surprised to know that Smithfield is actually is owned by the China-based WH Group. Another big company, the National Beef Company, Beef Packing Company, which is the fourth largest beef processor in the United States, is now approximately 80% owned. Another very large company is JBS. It is a powerful Brazilian company. The Brazilian government actually found that Brazilian meat companies, including JBS, were bribing inspectors. Well, we have two fundamental problems with the consolidation. First, you know, the problem is the economic power of these companies. And the second is that the folks are importing, these companies don't have to comply with standards as rigorous as the United States does. They're supposed to, but in fact they don't. So for example, in Australia and Canada, they both have systems that allow for significant private plant inspection. And the USDA has deemed that that's equivalent to the United States system, even though the U.S. system recently finalized it and it's still being challenged in court. We have a petition now to try to revoke this. This summer we revised it because we have discovered that there were increased in shipments that had to be stopped into the United States from Australia due to fecal matter on beef and lamb from their own privatized inspection system. So it's foreign influence can definitely impact our own local supply as well.
Zach, unfortunately, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time here, but I wanted to ask you about the pigs themselves. I remember reading in Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, about these pigs. You know, they're very intelligent animals. They're sentient creatures, and they're smart, and they know what's going on. And what I read was that the level of screams and cries in the slaughterhouses themselves are so horrific that it really just affects the workers who are there, too. It's like a Holocaust, in a sense. Can you tell me about the situation there, ventilation, how many pigs are slaughtered in this country annually? Do we export these animals to foreign markets?
So you have to remember, we slaughter 130 million hogs every single year. Hog companies can slaughter 1,106 hogs per hour. So this is the industry that we now face. It is quite an industrialized system.
Well, how can we contact Food and Water Watch?
So our website is foodandwaterwatch.org. And I encourage everybody to check that out. And we also, you can follow us on Twitter at Food and Water.
Excellent. Zach Corrigan, we so much appreciate your being on Law and Disorder today. We want to thank you, and we wish you every best in your work. We totally support you.
Sure. Well, thank you. We can be where our website is foodandwaterwatch.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Food and Water.
Thank you, Zach Corrigan. Thank you, Tamara Bedick, for being our guest host on this show. Zach, we wish you all the best. You take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
We have a new TaxCast hosted by Naomi Fowler coming up after these latest headlines from Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives has approved a bill aimed at combating domestic terrorism following last weekend's attack by a white supremacist who killed 10 black people in a Buffalo supermarket. The Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act passed on a vote of 222-203 Wednesday with the support of just one Republican lawmaker. It calls for the creation of a domestic terrorism offices within the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security. Meanwhile, New York State is launching an investigation into social media platforms used by the Buffalo shooting suspect. Governor Kathy Hochul announced the investigation Wednesday.
Today, I'm announcing a referral to the Attorney General's office to investigate the social media platforms that broadcast this horrific attack, that promote and elevate hate speech, and legitimize the replacement theory in the mind of an 18-year-old. A radicalized 18-year-old.
Governor Hochul also announced a series of steps to tighten New York's gun laws. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with Chris Brown, head of Brady, one of the oldest gun violence groups in the U.S. In Ukraine, the International Committee of the Red Cross has begun registering hundreds of Ukrainian fighters as prisoners of war after they surrendered in Mariupol. Russia now says over 1,700 Ukrainians have surrendered since May 16th after a weeks-long standoff at the Azovstal steel plant. Russia has threatened to hold war crimes trials for some of the captured soldiers. Meanwhile, a 21-year-old Russian soldier has pleaded guilty in the first war crimes trial conducted by Ukraine since the start of the invasion. The soldier admitted to shooting dead a 62-year-old Ukrainian man in the region of Sumy. For the first time in over a year, the United States has an ambassador to Ukraine. On Wednesday, the Senate confirmed Bridget Brink by unanimous voice vote without a formal roll call. The post has been vacant since then. President Trump forced Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch out of the role in 2019 as Trump sought to pressure Ukraine's government into providing dirt on Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. Meanwhile, the Kremlin said Wednesday it would expel 85 embassy staff from French, Italian, and Spanish diplomatic missions after the three countries expelled hundreds of Russian diplomats. Russia has also closed the Moscow bureau of the Canadian broadcaster CBC and stripped its journalists of their visas and accreditation. A Russian foreign ministry spokesperson said the decision came after Canada's telecommunications regulator stopped distributing two Kremlin-sponsored channels.
A recent example was the ban imposed by the Canadian authorities on Russian TV channels Russia Today and Russia Today France from broadcasting in the country. We said that we would respond symmetrically in a similar way, however you like to call it, adequately, and now we are responding.
The U.S. Air Force says it carried out a successful test of a new type of hypersonic missile over the weekend. The Pentagon says a B-52 bomber off the coast of Southern California successfully test-fired an air-launched rapid response weapon that reached five times the speed of sound. The test of the nuclear-capable missile follows similar tests by China, and after Russian President Vladimir Putin said he's deployed hypersonic missiles during Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Finland and Sweden have agreed to a joint purchase of new weapons and ammunition. The arms deal was announced Wednesday as the two nations formally submitted their applications to join the NATO military alliance. The deal would include the purchase of anti-tank weapons from the Swedish weapons maker Saab. President Biden's meeting in Washington today with leaders of Finland and Sweden in a show of support for their applications to join NATO. Later today, Biden departs on a six-day trip to Asia, where he's scheduled to meet with leaders of South Korea, Japan, India, and Australia. Biden's trip comes amidst increased naval tensions with China, as analysts say North Korea is preparing an underground nuclear weapons test in the coming days, which will be the first such test since 2017. Israel's military has decided not to open a criminal investigation into the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. That's according to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Witnesses and fellow journalists say the Palestinian-American journalist was killed by an Israeli soldier while reporting on an Israeli military raid in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Abu Akleh's family has told Al Jazeera that they will not be surprised if Israel fails to investigate her killing. The Centers for Disease Control's warning U.S. residents to consider wearing masks in indoor settings amidst a new surge of infections caused by mutant forms of the Omicron coronavirus variant. The average number of confirmed daily coronavirus infections across the U.S. has topped 100,000 for the first time since February, and that total fails to account for cases that go unreported or undetected by at-home tests. New York City raised its COVID alert level to high Wednesday, even as Mayor Eric Adams rejected calls to impose mask mandates and other public health measures.
Variants are going to come. If every variant that comes, we move into shutdown thoughts, we move in through panicking, we're not going to function as a city.
On Wednesday, Health and Human Services Secretary Becerra said he tested positive for coronavirus during a trip to Germany and is isolating in Berlin with mild symptoms. Meanwhile, President Biden's daughter, Ashley Biden, has tested positive for COVID, will cancel plans to join First Lady Jill Biden on a trip to Central and South America. The Kansas Supreme Court has upheld a Republican-created congressional voting map rejected by voting rights groups as a result of partisan and racial gerrymandering. Kansas's new map lowers the reelection chances of Democratic Representative Sharice Davids, who made history in 2018 by becoming one of the first two Native Americans elected to Congress. In Wisconsin, two Democrats who served as Electoral College delegates have filed a first-of-its-kind lawsuit against a slate of fake electors put forward by allies of Donald Trump in a bid to overturn Joe Biden's 2020 victory. President Biden's invoked the Defense Production Act in order to address the nationwide baby formula shortage and hopes that the Korean War-era law will boost the domestic manufacturing of formula. Biden's decision to invoke the DPA underscores the severity of the shortage, which has left store shelves bare and many parents desperate to feed their infants.
The Defense Production Act gives the government the ability to require suppliers to direct needed resources to infant formula manufacturers before any other customer who may have ordered that good. I'm also announcing Operation Fly Formula. That's to be able to speed up the import of infant formula and start getting more formula in stores as soon as possible.
To see our interview with David Dayan, you can go to democracynow.org on monopolies. On Wednesday, the House passed a $28 million emergency funding bill for the Food and Drug Administration in order to address the formula crisis. Here in New York, a 31-year-old Rikers Island prisoner has died of what officials at the jail said was a drug overdose. Mary Yehuda was discovered in medical distress in a women's unit at Rikers Island Tuesday. She died early Wednesday in a nearby hospital in Queens. Yehuda is the fifth Rikers prisoner to die this year, the 21st since the start of 2021. Last month, the U.S. Justice Department said it might take control of the Rikers Island jail complex, citing an extraordinary level of violence and disorder at the jails. In Minnesota, former Minneapolis police officer Thomas Lane has pleaded guilty to a charge of second-degree manslaughter over his role in the murder of George Floyd 2 years ago. Video of the 2020 killing shows Lane helped to restrain Floyd as then-officer Derek Chauvin pressed his knee into Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes, killing him. Lane faces a suggested sentence of 36 months in prison. Two other former officers, Tu Tao and J. Alexander King, still face charges of aiding and abetting George Floyd's murder at a trial scheduled in a state court next month. In a new landmark labor agreement, the U.S. Soccer Federation will be paying members of its women's and men's teams equally. The deal stipulates soccer players will receive the same pay when competing in international matches, and in an historic provision, dictates U.S. Soccer will address the gender disparity in the amount of prize money awarded by soccer's governing body, FIFA, by pooling the prizes and redistributing them equally across members of both teams. And as the Supreme Court appears poised to strike down Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion across the U.S., Democratic Congressmember Lucy McMath made an emotional appeal Wednesday, highlighting how attacks on abortion rights can impact treatments available to patients who, like her, have experiences with miscarriage and stillbirth. McMath spoke at a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee.
After which failed pregnancy should I have been imprisoned? Would it have been after the first miscarriage? After doctors used what would be an illegal drug to abort the lost fetus? Would you have put me in jail after the second miscarriage? Perhaps that would have been the time. Forced to reflect in confinement at the guilt I felt, the guilt that so many women feel after losing their pregnancies. Or would you have put me behind bars after my stillbirth? After I was forced to carry a dead fetus for weeks, after asking God if I was ever going to be able to raise a child, and I asked because the same medicine used to treat my failed pregnancies is the same medicine states like Texas would make illegal.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. If you're on Twitter, we're on Twitter handle TheTaxCast. If you want to make sure you never miss a TaxCast, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Okay, so we're hearing a lot from world leaders about sanctions against Russian oligarchs at the moment. We know financial secrecy is what the powerful, the corrupt and criminals really love. With financial secrecy, they can undermine the democratic will of any country's government. They can drain the tax revenues that stop the rest of us living secure and happy lives. So, which nations are the world's worst offenders when it comes to financial secrecy? I'm going to tell you. Because this month, the Tax Justice Networks released the latest results of the Financial Secrecy Index 2022. Our specialist team ranks countries every 2 years on how secretive their financial and legal systems are. Then they combine that with how big a financial secrecy global player they are. In other words, how much damage they're doing in the world. So, what this isn't is a list of the world's most secretive jurisdictions, as is sometimes misreported. This is a list of countries ranked according to the level of secrecy services a country offers customers, combined with its size as a global player. I'll give you an example. The very beautiful Maldives is a highly secretive jurisdiction, but it's a really small player globally, so it doesn't have a significant impact on global financial secrecy, so it's not at the top of the index. So it's logical, isn't it, that the bigger a financial secrecy supplier a nation is, the more responsibility they have to reduce their secrecy services because they're doing more damage. So, this is a ranking you don't want to be at the top of. Here's the top 10. Our 2022 Roll Call of Shame. At number one is the United States, with the worst rating ever recorded by the Financial Secrecy Index. Number two is Switzerland. Joining the top three for the first time is Singapore. Number four, Hong Kong. Number five, Luxembourg. Number six is Japan, which increased its supply of financial secrecy to the world by 10%. Germany's shot up to number 7 from 14th place last time. It's increased its secrecy supply by a third. A very bad result for them. So much for all that cheap talk on sanctions on oligarchs. And at number 8, the United Arab Emirates. At least they don't pretend to care about oligarchs. Number 9, the British Virgin Islands, a British overseas territory. And number 10, Guernsey, a British Crown Dependency. God save the Queen, the fascist regime. And yes, don't be fooled by the United Kingdom not being in the top 10. This time, the UK is at the number 13 spot. But, as is always the case, I'm ashamed as a British person to tell you that when you combine Britain with all its satellite havens around the world, it is still the world's worst offender. We're going to talk about Britain later, and of course the shockingly bad result for the United States, and how other G7 states, Japan, Germany and Italy, are holding back progress. By the way, when it comes to China, it's zoomed up to number 11 in the index. And what China does is extremely impactful on, for example, Africa, since China's their biggest trading partner. Anyway, there are 141 countries assessed in the index, so there's plenty more fascinating stuff there. I asked head of the Tax Justice Network, Alex Cobham, for his reaction to the 2022 Financial Secrecy Index results.
I guess the least surprising thing was the US actually getting to the top as the biggest global threat. But the kind of the backsliding of the G7 was a bit unexpected. I hadn't thought we'd see that across that set of the most powerful countries. But the biggest surprise was Cayman. Cayman has dropped from the top out of the top 10. And surprising because of the reason for it. You know, they've spent so long. I think Cayman Finance has put more money and more time than anyone in the world into criticizing the index. And you know, the index rightly judges them as highly secretive. To be fair, they have genuinely improved this year. Their secrecy score is down from 76 to 72. mainly because the UK required it to join the UN conventions on terrorist financing and the Convention Against Corruption. But the reason the rank has dropped so sharply is because all of this time they've been refusing to publish the information about their share of international financial services exports, and now they've finally done it. And it's revealed that their global role is actually much smaller than we and pretty much everybody else had always estimated from the data that they do actually allow to become public. Now what that means is that they must have known all of this time that their ranking in the index was seriously overinflated, and I suppose they took the decision that they'd rather look like they were the really, really bad guys than actually come clean and tell people that they're not quite such a big player in global finance as they were allowing people to think. So that's the big surprise. Of course, you know, the UK and its set of dependent territories remains the biggest overall problem, despite Cayman's improvements.
That's interesting. I mean, when it comes to the G7 nations, the Financial Secrecy Index points a finger really, really strongly at the US, the UK, Japan, Germany and Italy. And, you know, they have been shouting the loudest about sanctions on Russian oligarchs. Yet we now know through the Financial Secrecy Index results that they're responsible for cutting back progress on the financial transparency that would have allowed sanctions to happen. I mean, complete hypocrisy. What is going on with that?
It's kind of fascinating, isn't it? You know, this set of countries, these are not the most secretive jurisdictions in the world, not by a long shot. But they are big players, and so their secrecy matters. They have a big share of global financial services, and so when they are more secretive, it poses a bigger risk to everyone else. As you say, what's happened this year is that the progress that would have been made if the G7 had just stood still has been cut by more than half, because actually they've gone backwards. Then Canada and France, to round out the G7, actually both getting slightly better, so well done them. Showing, you know, it can be done, including within the EU, but it takes a bit of commitment. So it's a slightly depressing picture. You know, these are the countries, as you say, in this moment of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that are looking to make sanctions effective, and they need to be looking at themselves and saying, the way that we deny progress on financial transparency doesn't just deny the ability of other countries to tax fairly and to act against corruption, it also denies our own ability to impose effective sanctions if we want to. You have to hope that if there's a silver lining to any of that, it's a recognition, including among these most powerful countries, that allowing anonymous wealth is undermining for all of us, and we just have to finally push through and deliver on the beneficial ownership transparency, knowing who is buying companies, trusts, foundations, partnerships, and bank accounts, so that we can all be broadly confident that law and order is applied across the board and that the system works and that we can tax progressively.
Yeah, and another trend which, I mean, tell me if I'm right or not in suspecting that when it comes to autocratic states, there's a sort of a rise in the use of those states for financial secrecy, and surely oligarchs worldwide will be observing all this talk about sanctions against prominent Russians. Now, we've seen in this index, very interestingly, the rise of the United Arab Emirates. Singapore has risen a lot too, which I know it's a democracy, but it's also described by many as a thinly veiled autocracy. Hong Kong also. Could this be a future trend in your view, and what would that mean?
I think it's definitely crystallising as a trend. And remembering that the index is, in a sense, backward-looking because it takes a long time to bring together the data, the trends we're actually seeing this year aren't yet reflected in the index, and so it's already going to go further than what we're seeing in the index now. And I think the way you frame it is spot on. We're seeing a shift, which I think we can probably think is broadly positive, but with some caution. It's a shift away from the secrecy jurisdictions, the tax havens that have sold themselves as offering good governance, tax neutral investment platforms for the concerned international investor, right? Where the key thing, in a sense, is that you're saying, you know, if you have a dispute, our legal systems are absolutely straight and you'll be appropriately protected. Your property rights will be protected. Now, you may be doing all sorts of bad things elsewhere, but not to worry, we'll look after you. What we're seeing now, as you say, is a shift towards a set of jurisdictions that really don't make those claims about good governance, or at least not with any seriousness, because, you know, the common thread, Hong Kong, Singapore, the United Arab Emirates, is a pretty much complete disregard for human rights. They may still claim that they've got systems in place to protect investors, but not as human beings, only as, you know, the sources of money. And I think the fact that we're seeing that shift, we're seeing secrecy services increasingly going to that sort of jurisdiction, is a positive sign in that it reflects a kind of marginalization of illicit financial flows. It's no longer something that you can just do through London or Delaware. And, you know, this is good business practice and everyone says, oh, that's probably okay. Increasingly, we're seeing people, not least Russian oligarchs, in effect, being openly in defiance of the application of laws or sanctions that others try to put on them, and going to these places where most other people are denied full human rights as a choice. So this is not something you can defend as good governance or investment practice or anything else. This is clearly nothing more than an attempt to defy others making their own laws effective on you. And you're so keen to do that, that you're willing to hold your nose about whatever other practices that jurisdiction has. So I don't think you could say, you know, this is anything like the end of the road, but I think we'll look back in a few years and this might seem like a bit of a turning point, when that kind of good governance, investor protection argument for secrecy jurisdictions was finally nailed, and it became clear that, you know, this is about hiding and cheating and dodging and abusing and nothing else. And if you want to do it, well, you do it over there and the rest of us will make our own judgments about you. But let nobody pretend this is good investor behaviour or anything of the sort.
That's really interesting. And I mean, we shouldn't be that surprised, because in the end, you know, tax havens and secrecy jurisdictions are fundamentally anti-democratic. But the G7's going to have to up its game, you know, a lot. And that's what we are getting strong and clear from the secrecy index, isn't it? I mean, together, some of those nations, they've increased their supplies of financial secrecy. Italy and Germany by a third, Japan by 10%, the UK by 2%. The US, well, that's the worst rating ever recorded since the ranking began in 2009.
Yeah. Look, it's, you know, it's an interesting time to see whether or the extent to which the financial sector, broadly defined, takes heed of what's going on. So, you know, I was looking at earlier this year, thinking about the British Virgin Islands. So here's a jurisdiction, a UK dependency, under investigation by the UK, and that takes a lot, you know, for the depth of its corruption. And the question you're asking yourself is, like, this is a major provider of anonymous companies used by investors of some description all around the world, and a certain number of major multinationals and financial services firms too. Are those firms, those kind of mainstream responsible financial actors, are they going to stay in the BVI, or are they going to say no? And, you know, and now that the UK has confirmed in its findings the depth of the corruption, what's their decision? Do you say, okay, we can't be there, it's just, it's so obvious that we're just there to cheat people and you know, there can't be any kind of good governance argument or anything? Or do you say, look, we don't care, we need the secrecy, we need the ability to cheat, so we're going to stay anyway and we'll take a bit of a reputational hit? But now there's a lot more of the financial services actors around the world finding that they're in places that are really increasingly going to be seen, or are seen, as kind of beyond the pale. So what do you do? I think we're going to see a bit of a separation. And, you know, it's, I guess, the tide going out to some extent. We'll see who's naked. You know, we'll see who really needs the secrecy, regardless of the reputational damage, and who has some kind of slightly more genuine commitment to responsible financial services practice.
Yes, the secrecy space is being squeezed, and the index team did identify a 5% global reduction in financial secrecy, although the increases in the G7 nations I mentioned really cuts that progress right back. But let's look at the number one global offender, the United States. Wow. I mean, after all the Biden administration has said about tackling tax havens and about sanctioning oligarchs, I mean, they've increased their financial secrecy supply to the world by almost a third, the largest supply ever recorded by the index. That's despite some fantastic anti-corruption coalitions in the States and achievements like the passing of the Corporate Transparency Act, finally passed after so many years of trying. I spoke to Ryan Garuli of the FACT Coalition in the United States about the result for his country.
I think that there are a lot of different factors that contribute to the score. The score itself is not surprising. There are a couple of different factors that contribute to it and things that we've seen as well. First and foremost, the U.S. is behind in implementing transparency-based reforms, and we know this. In fact, the U.S., which kind of kicked off the whole global transparency movement with FACA, which is the U.S. foreign account transparency mechanism, in which U.S. financial accounts held offshore are reported back to the U.S., that system is not reciprocal at all.
He means that while the United States insists on other countries sharing information on their citizens abroad, it doesn't return the favor. So information on the citizens of the world's activities in the United States remain locked in secrecy. Yes, really.
And in the meantime, after the U.S. kind of created that system, it failed to engage with the world in making a more reciprocal information exchange system in tax, and it failed to keep up in other transparency reforms related to beneficial ownership of entities, real estate, private investment funds, and regulating the enablers that help potentially corrupt actors access the extremely enticing U.S. financial system. And it's enticing for a variety of reasons. The U.S. financial system has very strong legal protection, and it offers anonymity and complete secrecy. I think it's a bit of a wake-up call, especially in light of what's happening in the world. Right now, we've seen Russia invade Ukraine. We're talking about an authoritarian nation invading a democratic country. And what we're seeing when the United States is leading, along with our allies, a global response in sanctioning the oligarchs that are part of Putin's cadre, it's difficult to do that if you don't know where those oligarchs are keeping their money and hiding it. And from that perspective, I think that the Western countries are recognizing that they've been playing a significant role in entrenching and empowering those regimes by allowing kleptocrats to pilfer from their own country and move that money back to secure, secretive Western jurisdictions, like U.S. markets, that are very attractive, and to do so on a completely anonymous basis. That has only entrenched the power at home, emboldened their actions, and is resulting in a lot of the global conflict that we're seeing. So I think that wake-up call, along with this score, will be a real call to act.
There are chinks of light, though, despite this disastrous scoring for the United States. And that might not come into view until the next Financial Secrecy Index in 2024. I mean, you've had the Corporate Transparency Act finally passed after so many years of trying. Once that's fully implemented, there should be some serious progress that should filter into the next results.
Yeah, the United States has begun to act. And the Corporate Transparency Act was passed in January of 2021. And for the first time, that will require the disclosure of beneficial ownership of most legal entities in the United States. Corporations, limited liability companies, we expect it to cover every limited partnership, but we are waiting on finalized regs to confirm as much. However, there are a couple of things that are holding that up, especially as it relates to this score. For one thing, that bill hasn't been implemented. The Corporate Transparency Act passed in January 2021, but there's a tremendous amount of regulatory work to stand up the rules around that statute and the framework itself, as well as to stand up the infrastructure from a tech and digital information perspective to make sure that the law works as intended. But at the same time, the U.S. regulatory agency responsible for setting those rules up and that infrastructure up is horribly underfunded, and they're being pulled in a lot of different directions. And that's the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network at the Treasury Department, FinCEN. They've been called into action in connection with the aggression towards Ukraine in helping coordinate international sanctions, including to discover who actually owns these entities. But it would be a lot easier to do that if these structural reforms had been in place a long time ago. The last thing I'll say is the president, he has emphasized these things. He's actually identified a lot of core tenets that would both address the financial secrecy index score, but more importantly, actually create a more transparent regulatory environment in the U.S. that would not only help to enforce sanctions, but also to help prevent the need for sanctions in the future, because it would undermine the abuse of Western financial systems by kleptocrats. Those reforms include standing up and implementing the Corporate Transparency Act, bringing greater transparency to U.S. real estate markets on a nationwide permanent basis with respect to commercial and residential real estate, regulating the enablers who bring and shelter assets within our financial system, bringing transparency to private investment funds, an $11 trillion industry in the United States that has no know-your-customer or beneficial ownership rules, which is shocking. That would be the third largest economy in the world, and it's a black hole of secrecy. And finally, covering other areas that have been developing and that are of concern, including relating to luxury assets, bringing transparency to art, antiquities, and digital assets, making sure that those, you know, emerging categories of harms from a money laundering perspective are pulled into the traditional anti-money laundering frameworks. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. We just need to make sure that they're covered. Right now, the U.S. is itself a tax haven. It's one of the biggest secrecy jurisdictions in the world. These results confirm that. And it's no longer time for the U.S. to pretend that it can enact and create a less corrupt global environment and foster democracy without looking internally and cleaning up its own house and catching up with global norms, making sure that its rhetoric is more than just talk. It's time to walk the walk.
Ryan Garule of the FACT Coalition. Okay, let's talk about the UK. As I've said, combined with all its satellite havens, it's still the worst offender, even though, taken alone, it's ranked number 13. Unlike the United States, though, there aren't any encouraging signs. Alex Cobham again of the Tax Justice Network.
You can say that Britain is eating itself. You know, it's slightly sad. You know, we're sitting here as two Brits. You know, on the one hand, look, I think the world is increasingly aware that the UK is the biggest driver of financial secrecy, of tax havenry. The UK is the UK, and I think let's come back to the next index and see where the UK is. The UK government at present is absolutely not committed to transparency in almost any dimension, whether that's freedom of information requests from journalists or the public, or it's transparency about public procurement and public contracts, or indeed a great many other things, including financial secrecy. They haven't delivered. In fact, they've U-turned on a set of commitments that the predecessor, but still conservative, government made, including around country-by-country reporting, and the UK's corruption is becoming both more pervasive and more visible, which is what you'd expect with a country that sits at the centre of this spider's web of secrecy. We know financial secrecy corrodes, and it corrodes in the secrecy jurisdiction as much as it does damage to others. The UK is responsible for very serious revenue losses for other countries, but it also suffers very serious revenue losses itself. It is increasingly finding it difficult to make progressive taxation effective because the tolerance of anonymous wealth and opaque corporate accounting is so high, and it's so embedded politically that we don't regulate this stuff properly. And even if we pass the laws, we don't enforce them. The cost now to the British society is becoming increasingly clear. I think, you know, there will be a moment in UK politics when people say, we have to try something else.
Yeah. It's like a lost nation at the moment, a pariah nation even. And there's this ongoing race to the bottom happening between New York and London, which you can also throw into the mix. But speaking about how to tackle long-term these problems, I mean, the Tax Justice Network and other anti-corruption campaigners want a global asset registry and a United Nations tax convention. I know these are big subjects, but can you briefly explain how the global asset registry would work practically?
Sure. So, you know, we already have registries of a lot of assets. You know, so a lot of countries have a land registry that records, depending either the legal owner or ideally the ultimate warm-blooded beneficial owner. And then a lot of countries have that for companies, and an increasing number of countries have that for trusts and foundations as well. Then if you look at kind of high-value assets like yachts and private aircraft, you often have registers, sometimes international, of who the owners are. And then even thinking about works of art in some cases, and other assets, we see similar types of registers. Now, not all of them are perfect. Not all of them identify the beneficial owner or don't do it entirely effectively. But there's a lot of information there, most of it public, some of it held privately, that could be joined up. And that's really what a global asset registry is, the idea that you could actually put together the company ownership register for all jurisdictions, and then the same for other types of assets, other types of legal vehicles. And you'd end up with an overall structure that, let's say, law enforcement would be able, imagine, for example, that you wanted to sanction some very rich oligarch or, you know, some major criminal. You could look through the global asset registry and effectively see every element of their ownership, every structure and every ultimate asset. And that would allow you equally to do things like taxing wealth effectively if you wanted to. Not all of the information would be in the public domain, as it's not now. Some of it would be private. Certainly, I don't think anyone's saying we should have information about people's financial accounts in the public domain. But where you've created a legal vehicle to do business, then that's, I think, generally held should be a factor of public information. So you'd have both public and private elements, and it would basically be a tool for different types of law enforcement, but also civil society, journalists, and so on, for all of us to understand, really, the distribution of wealth in our countries and internationally, and if we wanted, to decide to tax it, or at least, if we're not going to tax it, to make that decision actively and with the power to do so, and be choosing democratically not to if that's a choice that's made. So it's really about empowering people, both to make sure that laws and taxes are applied fairly, but also to allow us to curtail inequalities.
Okay, and the United Nations Tax Convention, so important to enshrine tax rights in a legally enforceable way to protect citizens. That's another longer term thing we'd like to see happen, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not so sure it's long term anymore. I think we've had a shift. There's been a sense that, you know, the OECD has actually had 10 years on corporate tax and it's failed. You know, nobody, including the big OECD members, nobody is happy with what the OECD's put on the table after 10 years of trying. That's on the corporate tax side. Meanwhile, on the transparency side, you know, we have the Financial Action Task Force, whose former long-standing head has just come out and, you know, really ripped them apart and highlighted just how much they have failed to achieve things like beneficial ownership, transparency, among more than a, you know, a handful of members, and how actually there's a small group of major members who really control it and stop it delivering high standards for everyone. We know the UN Tax Committee already has kind of delivered on digital taxation in a way that the OECD is failing. It's kind of obvious that this stuff should be done at the UN. My feeling is we might see negotiations on a convention begin within a year. It really feels we could be that close. And there's still a long way to go even if we get started. But I think there's just this general sense that the architecture doesn't work. It doesn't work for lower income countries, in fact it never has done, but even for OECD members I think there's a frustration that they're not getting the kind of effective changes that they need. And something like the failure of the G7 to be able to make sanctions effective in the case of Russia, because of their own failure to be transparent, I think is shifting the dial on what might be acceptable as global standards. So, I feel pretty positive at the minute. I think it's not such a long-term ambition after all.
And very interestingly, the African Union has just passed a resolution calling on the United Nations for a tax convention. Alex, I'm cheered to see that the Financial Secrecy Index 2022 finds that global financial secrecy actually shrank by 5%, so it is going down. But once you factor in the G7 countries I mentioned earlier, them increasing their secrecy services by so much, it's whittled down that global percentage to 2%. But it is still an ongoing reduction, which is encouraging, even though in the last index it was down by 7%. I know that enforcement is a whole other thing, a whole other question, but the secrecy space is being squeezed, and that's a very important ongoing shift, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You could say the continuing improvement in global transparency is really a reflection of the kind of the normalisation of the tax justice policy platform. There is much more automatic exchange of information about financial accounts. There is much more transparency of beneficial ownership. And there is continuing progress towards country-by-country reporting being transparent. There's a lot of progress being made, so we should feel pretty positive. Stuff is being delivered in legislation, but it's also being delivered in practice. The fact that the G7 as a group is dragging the needle back the wrong way is a definite cause for concern. But that global trajectory is positive, and it feels like the momentum will continue.
The Financial Secrecy Index 2022. I've given you just some of the highlights here. There's so much more to discover, and there's 141 countries in the index. So find out about your country on www.ssi.taxjustice.net. That's it for now from the TaxCast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month. Bye for now.